Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And Jim, for weeks now, we've all been discussing 999, the Herman Cain tax plan, 9% personal income tax rate, corporate tax rate also 9%, and of course the new 9% national sales tax, which is the source of most of the debate and concern in some conservative circles. But not to be outdone, Rick Perry, who is being outdone by Cain and Mitt Romney and Newt Gingrich and Ron Paul in the polls right now, has come out with his flat tax, which not surprisingly has won the strong endorsement of Steve Forbes. But Perry unveiling it today, he wants a 20% flat tax rate that is optional. It's almost a little bit reminiscent of what the president claimed was true with Obamacare. If you like your current tax code, you can keep it. But if you would rather pay a 20% flat tax rate, you can. Pretty generous personal and dependent exemptions. You still get some of the deductions, not all of them, but like your mortgage deduction and charitable contributions and so forth. So I don't know if it's enough to raise Rick Perry back to the frontier here, but it certainly is a tax plan that a lot of conservatives are going to like, whether or not they actually think it's feasible to be implemented.
Yeah, I nominate this as the good martini because I think this is a sign of a somewhat more serious Rick Perry campaign. I think you can argue that he was, up until maybe that last debate, we could argue that he was not running for president so much as he was moseying for president. And, you know, one of the things that a candidate does is they unveil their proposals. They unveil their ideas. They showcase a vision for the country. This is a pretty big and bold one. Now, I say big and bold, and I don't necessarily say workable. This is going to be, this would be an extraordinarily difficult to enact. Nonetheless, there's nothing particularly wrong for it. I mean, if, you know, the beginning of your campaign is that there's time for compromise down the road. At this point, just give us your vision. Give us your sense of what it would be. And instead of 999, we have 2020, as as Barbara Walters would say. But what's more, in the conference call that his team was holding earlier today, basically it was kind of a wish list for conservatives. And I'm not saying this is realistic, but he wants to freeze federal government salaries until the budget is balanced. Not going to be very popular in Washington, D.C. and Northern Virginia, where I am. End all earmarks. Repeal Obamacare. Repeal Dodd-Frank. Pass a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution. Obviously, that would require a lot more than presidential action. Cut $100 billion from non-defense discretionary spending in the first year. Paygo for all new federal programs. This means you have to cut as much from existing spending as you create in new spending. You know, this is kind of, you know, it's like Christmas for economic conservatives. This is stuff they've wanted to see for a really long time. I'm not 110% convinced that even under the best case scenarios, a President Perry would be able to enact any of this. But I just kind of feel like Rick Perry has woken up and that he's starting to act like a candidate who has something to lose and who wants to win this and who is getting engaged in the idea fight. And it's kind of interesting that I think after the splash that has been made by 999 and the general reaction you're seeing to 2020, one way or another, the Republican candidate for president is going to want a flatter tax. And I think that is good for the party, and I think that is good for the country. The wildly stratified system, it's all too easy to get the people to believe that government is free or government is something that other people primarily pay for. So that's why I'd say this is a good martini to start the day.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the Democrats will complain that we already have paygo rules and they've been so strictly enforced over the past 2 to 3 years that there's really no need to change that in any meaningful way. And Rick Perry's pointing out that the tax code, I think, has like 72,000 pages. And, of course, folks like Dodd and Frank will say, yeah, but what font size are they using? So, you know, it's not really all that complicated. On to martini number two now, and off we go once again to Lower Manhattan and the Occupy Wall Street protests. And Jim, we've heard everything from, defecating on police cars to anti-Semitic remarks to alleged sexual assaults to just complete sanitary chaos. But now, of course, we can put most of those to rest because Washington Post columnist Richard Cohen has wandered through the protests for a few minutes and decided that most of the more disturbing things that have been said about these hooligans in the park just simply aren't true because they didn't happen in the 10 minutes that he was there.
Yeah, and it may have been more than 20 minutes. He says he circled the place. This is in his column in today's Washington Post. I should backtrack and observe. Richard Cohen is one of those columnists where it's not quite that he flips a coin every day before he writes his column. But let's say he rolls the dice And if it comes up a one or a two, he writes a column that I like. And the other two columns that he'll write in every out of every three, I will absolutely loathe. Today he split because his first one is basically saying that based on his walking around Lower Manhattan, he didn't see any anti-Semitism, so all of this must be vastly overstated. Pay no attention to what you see on YouTube. Pay no attention to these other accounts you hear. There's nothing to be said. People like Jen Rubin and Bill Kristol are overhyping this, et cetera, et cetera. But then, at the end of it, he kind of recognizes that there's something silly about the way this is being covered. And he says, I'll just read two quick excerpts. Occupy Wall Street has become an event for its own sake, a destination for the aimless. It is something that occurs on countless iPhone cameras, a tourist attraction with the usual vendors, the usual Zaftig young women doing the usual arrhythmic dance, somehow missing the beat of many drums. The nostalgic scent of pot wafts occasionally through the air, and I feel so much younger. This, I'm sure, will bring an end to the Vietnam War. Greg, you and I would write, something like that. And then he continues, it seems, above all, a conspiracy to have left-leaning writers make jackasses of themselves by imparting grave and grand meaning to what is little more than a vast sleepover. So, we don't often offer kudos in our bad martini,
right?
But Richard Cohen does kind of have enough, wherewithal and good sense to realize what's going on here, which is a lot of baby boomer nostalgia. But also, the kind of blithe dismissal of the accusations of anti-Semitism. We shouldn't be surprised by Richard Cohen, but I think it's not necessarily doing this justice. Anytime you have people saying, oh, it's those nefarious rich people who are out to get us, Greg, in my experience, anti-Semitism is never more than, a few psychological meters away, so to speak. It's a very short jump from sinister bankers to sinister Jews, in my experience. So clearly not everybody at these Occupy Wall Street events are anti-Semites. Clearly, most of them just want to check out the girls in body paint. But there is kind of this disturbing undercurrent that I think we should not so blithely dismiss. But yeah, Richard Cohen need to give us two lines to laugh about. So
exactly. Good for him on that. And we could say for the first time, I think ever, and that's the bad martini. So we always say that about the good martini, unfortunately. On to the crazy martini now. And, the state of Florida and the Republican Party at the national level are not probably going to be exchanging a lot of Christmas cards. First of all, Florida nearly upset the whole apple cart, and in a lot of ways still did, by moving up their presidential primary over the fierce objections of the National Party to late January. That forced this domino effect of South Carolina, Nevada, New Hampshire, and Iowa falling back into line even earlier. So we pretty much have the same schedule we did 4 years ago, which is very unfortunate. Now it turns out that Florida is turning its primary, and it has been before, I think, into a winner-take-all event, which means that Herman Cain's strategy, for example, of not necessarily winning a lot but coming in second a lot might need to be recalculated because that's going to be a lot of delegates. And after I think four or five other contests before that, that's going to be a very pivotal contest if there's not already huge momentum for one guy. And we pretty much know who that one guy in Florida is likely to be if he's still in good shape, which he probably will be, and that's Mitt Romney.
Yeah, it's one of those things where on the one hand, this is a decision that's up to Florida Republicans. I believe this is the way it was in 2008. Why you would make your state winner-take-all escapes me, because basically, if heading into it, you are not the front-runner or very close to being the front-runner, what's the point? It's a very quick way to turn your race into even more into a two-man race than it already is, and it kind of, to me, is a way to ensure your state gets less attention instead of more attention. There are a bunch of these guys, your Santorums, your Bachmans, your Ron Pauls, your Gingriches, and your Rick Perrys aren't necessarily going to win unless the field ends up being really, really, really divided. But you could get, 10, 15, 20%, and that's, nothing to sneeze at in most states. Now, in Florida, that will get you nothing. And that's, if you recall, the Rudy Giuliani strategy of last time, that he decided he didn't like any of the early primary states. He probably should have, taken a shot at New Hampshire. And so as a result, he put all of his eggs into the Florida basket. And by the time the Florida primary rolled around, he had been, finishing 7th, 8th, 9th for several consecutive primaries, and everybody kind of forgotten about him. It's not unthinkable that Florida, as a result of this, could end up picking the winner. And to be honest, as you suggested earlier, it's really kind of hard to see a scenario where it's not Romney, barring some total collapse of Romney in preceding states. I mean, this is going to, you know, Florida is going to be an expensive state to run in. Romney is going to have the financial resources. Perry probably will, and after that, it is a steep drop off. So, not sure I like this move by Florida. It is their decision, but it just kind of strikes me as a bizarre way to make your state less relevant to the process or less interesting and competitive than it already is. But then again, maybe there's some agenda behind that.
Jim, it just seems like a carbon copy of 2008 with shaking up the schedule. There probably won't be the delegate split like there was last time and, you know, the winner-take-all fiasco. But one thing that'll probably not be the same, I don't think the outcome will hinge on the endorsement of Charlie Crist. I'm just putting that out there.
Yes. Look, I mean, you were talking about things that could absolutely crush Romney's candidacy. I think Crist's endorsement would do that right there.
Exactly right. Hey, not that long till Iowa here. We're just a couple months away. So plenty to focus on, and we'll do it again tomorrow. Jim, have a great day.
Looking forward to it, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us again on Wednesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.